obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Woo! Hi, I'm Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
I thought you guys would all be sleeping. I just expected my family over there. Okay. So, I would like you to all imagine a blank canvas sitting right in front of you, and painted on that blank canvas is the totality of your life. All the people, places, and things on that canvas. All the colors, all the sadness, the joys, the birth, the death, the happiness. Imagine that canvas right in front of you. And now, I'm handing you a magic eraser. And you can select something out of that canvas to erase forever. What would that be? I heard that in a meeting once, and I thought, are you kidding me? I would erase everything. Absolutely everything. See, God made a mistake. He made me with brown skin. I was supposed to be born a little white Irish girl with freckles and green eyes. So the storks put me in the wrong house. God gave me the wrong skin color. Everything was a mistake about my life. I was also supposed to be born in a castle in Ireland. And no brothers and sisters, because they take up resources, like your parents' time and money. And I didn't like what we were living in, you know. We had a home that was, and God, and I wonder today why I have struggled through my adult life in my relationships with my sisters. I wondered for a long, long time why I was struggling. People feel what you are thinking. You act it out whether you ever say the words, but I really did. I'm sorry. I wanted to be an only child. Really sorry. Not anymore. But I grew up in this home, and my dad was the first drinker whose drinking bothered me. I don't know that he was alcoholic. I do know there was a lot of chaos in our home. I know that there was a lot of financial insecurity in our home. And my dad, you know, we've heard a lot of stories about the upbringings of people from speakers this weekend. And I didn't have any of that. I had a very mild kind of relationship in my upbringing than many of the speakers have shared about. My dad was just this drinker who would drink, pass out, be this lump on our living room couch. That was it. He was financially and emotionally unavailable most of the time to us and to my mom. And he was also what I've heard people call a periodic drinker, so he could go for extended periods of time without drinking. And when he did, oh my God, he was the light in our house. He was so fun. He was happy. He would dance down the halls. One time I'm walking in the house, and he's got this big, you know, like boombox kind of thing on his shoulders, and he's in his swim trunks. And he's in the house, and he's got a Coke in one hand and a little cooler, and he's holding it. And I look at him, and I said, are you going to the beach? And he goes, yeah, I'm going to the beach. And he walks into the bathroom, and he had filled up the tub. And he was just setting up his little beach right there. He was a fun kind of guy, you know? And thank God we had that, because my mom was the complete opposite. She was an untreated Al-Anon, you know? She was crazy. She yelled and threw things. She would throw chanclas. That's flip-flops. Flip-flops in English. And she was one of those manipulating, controlling, and also very, very much a victim. And I ended up taking the role as her supporter. I really did. I just took on that role of supporter from my mom. And I just heard too many things and knew too many things that kids shouldn't know. And thank God my dad had those periods of sobriety, because it brought some laughter into the home. You know, I have to say, in that home, I don't agree with alcoholism and growing up in alcoholism as a thing that really made my life miserable. I don't blame my father, and I don't blame my mother for the choices that I made and why I'm here. See, I grew up in that home with two other sisters, and they made seemingly normal choices in their lives. They have seemingly normal husbands and kids and jobs, and they never went down the roads that I went down. So what I believe today is there is something about my makeup, just something about my constitution that sees, that perceives things differently. And I took away the worst possible lessons I could possibly take away from that home. They did not. And I went on taking crazy lessons throughout my life. And I have chosen, I'm going to go back. I was in second grade. I remember this is how different I was. I was in second grade, and I was in the Brownie Girl Scouts. And I had this little uniform on, and this little hat, and this little red-orange tie thing you wear. And my mom is the leader of the Girl Scouts. Now, one thing you don't know about my mom is she is terrified, absolutely terrified. Jay talked about it, of being in front of people. And you know, she could do it with kids, that was fine. But this particular day in second grade, we had a PTA meeting, and the Girl Scouts had to go up and walk up with the flag through the center aisle, bring it up to the top, and it was my mom's job as troop leader to stand there and say, would everyone please rise, put your right hand over your heart, and say the Pledge of Allegiance. And we're standing at the back of a room just like this, and my mom is quivering. And she cannot come up to the front of the room. And she looks at me and says, Mija, it's like baby, Mija, when you get up there, you go to the microphone and you need to tell everybody to stand up and do the Pledge of Allegiance. And I did. Now, a normal person, and if my sisters had been in that spot, they would have probably been like, yeah, okay, Mom, I'll do it, whatever you say. I did that, but here's what I thought. Here's how my thinking process goes. I thought, I have just saved her ass. I have power and control. I can help people older than me. I got this thing. And I really believe my second grade brain just clicked into place that day, and I went full steam through my life with that idea. And I knew, I already knew about managing and controlling a little bit, because in the middle of the night, I had the room next to my parents, so I would hear things in the middle of the night, like on a school night, my mom would, I hear my mom, you SOB, why do you keep drinking? Why, blah, 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 don't you know? You know, that controlling stuff, and it would wake me up in the middle of the night, and then I'd hear my dad, Yoli, you're going to wake the kids up. Then I'd hear my mom, you asshole, if anybody's going to wake up the damn children, it's you. And so my little second grade brain would do things like fall out of bed, and if they didn't hear me because she was yelling too loud, I would get back in my bed and then fall down and take, you know, the lamp and the glass and whatever with me so I could stop. I could stop it for just a minute, you know. I was into doing this. I just believed I could fix it all and do it all and this managing thing. And I don't know why, somewhere in growing up, I just really grew up in this place of fear and self-esteem and darkness. I used to find my only comfort in the closet in my bedroom, and I would keep my little books in there and a flashlight, and I would just go in there and read and hide from the rest of the world. And I was always doing that. If I wasn't fixing you, I was hiding from you, you know. Not the best way to go about having grown-up relationships. I went to school, and I went to school by the grace of God and my sister. A friend of mine, I wasn't going to school. I had been given, I did really well in school, and I had been granted a scholarship. And when I graduated, I had such low self-esteem and so little faith in myself that I let that scholarship go to waste. And I chose not to go to school because I was going to be a cocktail waitress for my life. I don't know if you remember Flo from Mel's Diner, but I was going to tell you all to kiss my grits. She was so strong, and she didn't take shit from anybody, and I wanted to be her. And I'm at my waitressing job one day, and this other little waitress, we're putting on our aprons, and she looks at me and says, "Michelle, you're not like the rest of us. You're smart. You really need to go to school." And I said, "I don't know how to do that." And she said, "Well, go find somebody who does." And my sister, who was a year younger than me, I said, "I think I'm supposed to go to school. And I don't know why I listened to this girl. I think I'm supposed to go to school. And I don't really know how to do that. And I'm scared. Will you come with me to the library to research schools and applications?" And I just ended up going to a small community college because that girl said, "Just take a class you're interested in." So I took just a fun class. And little by little, year, day after day, I ended up getting a degree. And I got it by the skin of my teeth by the second grader who was saying, "I can do this. I can control this. Maybe this will help my family somehow." I didn't know. I was really ill-equipped at dealing with life already. And I ended up somewhere in those college years deciding that I didn't have enough, and I wasn't really around my family as much, and my dad's drinking at some point subsided for several years, and I missed the chaos. That's all I can tell you, is I missed the chaos. So I went looking for him, and I found him, because he's there. And I know they're there. I was sharing with Maria earlier. We fit, we fit each other. We fit in the other room, the guys over there and the women over there, we fit them. I'm walking through this crazy labyrinth of a hotel, trying to find, in my high heels, trying to find my room, building 14, and I get very disoriented just going from going on a straight line. And I'm walking, trying to find building 14, and I see these two women coming up from the pool, and they say to me, and they're AAs, and they say, "Do you know where building 14 is?" I said, "Oh my God, I'm going there too." "No, I don't know." And they said, "Damn it, just tell me you do." My gut response was, "Yeah, follow me," but it almost came out of my mouth, and I said, "I'm working on not doing that anymore." They said, "Damn it." I thought, we need each other. They want people like us to tell them what to do and where to go and how to do and fix it and pay the bills and do all those things. They want us, and we want them. We want them. And I thought, wow, yeah, this is why I'm here. This is why I'm here. So I found him, and it was, be careful what you wish for. He told me, he knew my family well, and he told me, "God, I just want to take you out and rescue you from your family." And I thought, well, yeah, this is it. But be careful what you wish for. It was a horrible relationship. It was horrible. And that relationship ended at some point, and all of my relationships were like that. They were all this place to hide back in that little girl's closet and read her books. I was trying to hide in something else, something that I thought everybody wanted me to do, and it wasn't the right place for me. It never was. It was. I was trying to fill that hole, that God hole, and it wasn't working. The relationships I chose were a lot like my father in some ways. I always picked the emotionally unavailable man, the lump on my couch, or the physically unavailable man, the man with the wedding ring, you know, or the man who was just, you know, too busy, the workaholic. And I did something that no one in my family to this day that I know of has ever done. I also picked dangerous men. And I put myself in a lot of dangerous situations. And it is by the grace of God that I did not know then I am alive today. I know that. I know that because the situations were life-threatening, some of them. One of those men that I chose to be with, I thought I loved him and I thought he loved me, and he raped me. And in the home that we had, he punched holes through walls and through things and broke windows with his anger. And I chose to stay. I chose to stay for a long time. And, you know, I thought for a very long time, I blamed him for a lot of my anger. I thought for a very long time. Now, I know this is different if you are a child, if you are in a helpless situation. I know it's completely different. I was an adult, grown woman, and I stayed in that relationship. And I had not grown up in anything near like that. And I know today that I chose to say that I was the victim of myself, that he didn't, I don't know why he did the things that he did. I do know that I stayed, that that was my choice. And I didn't ever have to put myself in that. After I left that relationship, I did what a lot of women who get abused do, and we don't talk about it too much in here, but, you know, I sought comfort in the arms of Tom, Dick, Harry, Joe, and I don't know who you are, and didn't care. And I was just on a horrible, wretched path. If that wasn't enough, all that anger, the fear, the disgust, I thought he took my power away, and I was wrong, and I was out searching for this new sense of power, and I was wrong. He never took my power away. I gave it away to him. I gave it away little piece by little piece, you know. And I went and I was trying to search, and I was just a miserable wretch, and I let this stuff start to spill over and pour over onto my career and onto my friendships. And I don't have any friends from that period of my life, and it is no wonder. Who would want to be around me? I was a mess. My work life, I chose to have affairs in my work life, and it's not a really good idea to have an affair in the workplace, because if the wife finds out, and they're a little crazy too, they tell your boss, and they threaten you and do some really scary things, so your boss puts a police detail on you when you are having evening events at work. And you know, I did something. I had to leave that job. It was ruining my reputation to make the choices, the silly choices I was doing. I was great at my job, but not at managing my life. And I needed to get out of that job. And my mom saved my butt. Now, she found me a job, another job, same career, same field, same thing. And I screwed that job up for my mom. This was somebody she trusted, somebody who was a friend. And I screwed that job up too. I met another woman who I now know today was probably a lot like me, letting her inside spill out all over you. And we actually somebody took a tape of her, had taped her unknowingly, and she actually said she woke up every morning trying to make my life miserable. And she would call me the queen bee. That was her bitch. And I woke up every morning receiving what she gave me and just trying to throw her under the bus, trying to get her caught by her supervisors, trying to get the other people around us in our environment and pit them against her. She'd do something to me, I'd do something to her. Now, normally that's okay, until someone like me makes a death threat and somebody else hears that, because they take that stuff seriously. And if you are ever going to make a death threat and do it in public, don't do it on federal property. It's not a misdemeanor, it's a federal offense. And they send investigators knocking on your door and your parents' door, and they take you to these rooms with these two-way mirrors, and they ask you questions, and you get, you know, restraining orders slapped against you and things like that. It's not good for you. Then you have to change your career. So in the middle of all of this crazy, I've had it. I've had enough. My dad dies in the same year, had died this same year, and I can't take another minute in my skin. I just can't do it, and alcohol doesn't work for me. I try everything. You know, I've tried eating, not eating. I've tried sex. I've tried celibacy. I've tried religions. I've tried atheism. I have tried everything. I tried alcohol. Nothing worked. Nothing worked. I was never comfortable in my own skin, and I walk to the bathroom of my apartment, and I'm sitting on this, I go grab a bottle of Valium, and I'm sitting on this big, beautiful king-size bed, and in this big, huge bed, I'm holding a bottle of Valium and a box of tissue, and I'm weighing them both, and the Valium is looking really, really good. And out of the corner of my eye, I catch a glimpse of a book, and it is my first God shot. I pick up this book. Now, this book was handed to me a month before by a coworker, and
to obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Sorry. She was one of those people who's happy, and I didn't like her. I did like that she had red hair and light skin and blue eyes, not the green ones I wanted. So that's probably the only reason I still had this book. But she'd come into my office one day, and she was bubbly and googly and said, "Oh, hi, I know you're going through a divorce and you're going through a lot of stuff right now. And I found this book and it saved my life, and it's not religious, it's just spiritual and blah, 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 blah." And I mean, get the hell out of my office. I can't take you another second. Give me the book. Yes, thank you. Will it make you go? And she left. And I stuffed that on the corner of my bedside table, and I picked it up that morning and or that evening, and I opened it up, and I'm still clutching the bottle of Valium, and the tissue was right next to me. And I opened the book up, and I'm reading it, and I slowly began to drop the Valium. It's not a program book, so I won't tell you a whole lot about it except for this. I knew it was talking to me, and at the end, at the very last paragraph in that first chapter, I read these words, that a woman like me, a person like me, needs a 12-step program. And this is why I know it's my God shot. I have read that book over and over again, and nowhere, nowhere are those words. But that night, they were there. And I did the only thing I needed to do, and I picked up my phone, and I called my mom, because that crazy, crazy woman I had grown up with, that yeller, that screamer, that thrower, she was walking with a lighter step, and I knew it had everything to do with you people. And you see, I was smarter than my mom. I had a degree. I had a degree in psychology, goddammit. So I couldn't fix me, but she got fixed. If she could get fixed, something might be possible for me. And I called that woman up, my mother, and I said, "Know that thing you go to on Tuesday nights?" And I said, just like that, because I didn't talk sweet back then. And she said, "What? What? Oh, do you mean my meetings?" You see, she had stop pushing me. She'd stop pushing me. She had become the principle or the tradition in our program of attraction rather than promotion. She truly lived that in her life. And she didn't even have a clue that I'd be asking about this thing I always talked shit about, you know? And so she said, oh, you mean my meeting? Why? Did you want to go? And I said, yes, I want to go with you. And she said, oh, okay, well, would you like me to pick you up or would you like to come over and we'll drive together? No, pick me up. And she had to drive 20 minutes out of her way to pick me up, and she did. And before she hung up on the phone, I said to her, now, I'm going to go to this thing with you, as if she had been asking me. But I don't want you to say a word about it. Don't you ask me about it. Don't you? We're never talking about this thing again. I don't want it. I don't want to. And I'm not going to say a thing when we're there. And she said, okay. And she kept her word. She truly kept her word. And she took me in this little meeting in Diamond Bar, and it's still there today, and it's still little. And at the time I went there, they were all, you know, we've heard all before, all the blue-haired women that I'm never going to be. My grandma kept her dark, beautiful black hair till she was very old. And I sat in this room, and there was about six women, and I sat on the floor. I could not take a seat with you guys. I sat on the floor. It was all little couches, so it was everybody was low, but I could, 3 months, I sat on that floor. I could not take a seat with you. But something was in that room. There was a lightness, you know. There's just a lightness I didn't have and I so desperately needed. And I remember there were women in there who really walked their talk in this program, and they were going through shit. Stuff was raining, and it was like they had these little umbrellas they could put up. And the rain didn't get soak them. And I thought, how in the hell do you do that? And those people, they never made me talk. You know, it must have been couple months, and there's only six of us. There's plenty of time in an hour and a half meeting for me to share, and they did not make me do it. They let me sit in that corner and lick my wounds. That's what I needed to do, and thank God. I just needed to listen to you. I just needed to start to come to believe that it might be true. And so one day, I got up off that floor. And I walked across the room to a woman named Marcy, and she changed my life. I said to her, Marcy, I want what you have. And she looked at me and she said, Michelle, if you want what I have, you have to do what I've done. And I had already figured that out by that time, which is why I knew to go and ask her. And Marcy said, Michelle, you're going to have to get a God going. And this is the first time I was ever honest with somebody. I looked right up at her and I said, Marcy, I don't know how to do that. And she said, well, you've heard about it here. If you need to believe in a doorknob as your God, believe in a doorknob. I couldn't do that. That just doesn't make sense to me. And she said, well then, Michelle, you borrow my God. There is enough of my God to go around for you, and you borrow him. And like a good old timer, she turned around and walked away and left me there. So I went home that night, and I said my first honest prayer, and it was, Dear Marcy's God. She said, there's enough of you for both of us, and I don't know if you really are there, but I know you're there for her. I don't know if you're going to be there for me, but if you're the God that she looks like she has, then there just might be a fraction of you available, and I hope you're listening. And I said that prayer for months and months and months. I was talking to my husband, and he said, what are you going to talk about tomorrow? And I said, well, Beth said this is supposed to be the spiritual talk. I don't know a whole lot about that. And he said, well, sure, what does spiritual mean? And I said, well, I know what the word means. I don't know what spiritual really is, you know. And I said I had looked it up, and I couldn't really find something that I liked. And there's really no agreement on the word spiritual or spiritual awakening or any of that stuff. So my husband and I were looking it up on the last night on our little phones, trying to figure out, you know, what does it really mean to be spiritual, and we couldn't find it. And picked up this book I had brought along, also not a program book, but it did define spiritual back from, I think it was the 1930s. And some people have heard of this man, but anyway, the definition, well, what it said was, the word alcohol is Latin for the word spiritus. And it went on to say that the same word that is used for the highest spiritual experience is also used for the most depraving poison. And I got it. I got it last night, because that's what I'm here to talk about. My poison, you see, my poison isn't alcohol, it's people, places, and things. I've learned that you will allow me to substitute that word, people, places, and things. That is my poison. And that is where, thank God today, I get my greatest spiritual strength, you know. And so I'm not going to talk about steps in order. I'm just going to talk about the experiences that really have brought me closer to and have defined my relationship with God and have changed it from Dear Marcy's God. One of the things, I used to attend a step study meeting early on, and one of the women in my meeting used to say every single meeting, God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. That's Sandy E, for those of you who know her. Happy, joyous, and free. And I'd hear that every meeting. And I thought, one day it came to me and I thought, really, happy, joyous, and free. Like, it doesn't matter what I wear. Doesn't matter how much money is in my pocket or what the guy looks like or any of those things. Like, I mean, God doesn't even care if I'm with Harry, Tom, Dick, or Joe, or all of them. He doesn't. And I really believe this today. He doesn't care if I'm having an affair. God just cares that I'm happy, joyous, and free, regardless of what my situations are, regardless of what's in front of me. And I don't know any Harry, Dick, or Tom that's ever made anybody really happy, you know. And I've learned that here through the women and men in these programs, because I've done what Marcy told me to do. I've done what you told me to do. You know, when Dell told me to shut up and serve some spaghetti, I got in the car and I shut up and I served spaghetti. I didn't know why I was doing it, but I just did it, you know. And when Dell told me I was selling raffle tickets, I sold raffle tickets, you know. And I've just been included. Just been included since the very beginning. And I was willing to change. Our speaker yesterday morning talked about change. I was willing to do it. I was willing to go there. I was willing to do something different. And so I listened to the little blue-haired ladies. And life started to get better. I was really trusting and believing in God, and I needed to make this career change early on. I did steps 1, 2, and 3 here. And then I went on a vacation that turned into a 2-year stint. I ended up in a job that paid me double my salary from before, and it led me on a new career path. I had no expectations of keeping to this day, and I'm really grateful for that. But that job took me to New York, and I ended up in New York alone. And I thought I was going to have family around me, but God sent them back to California when I showed up. So they said, here's so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. They'll be your new friends. And they were. And I went to I started going to meetings in New York. And they're different. They don't clap out in the meetings I went to. I didn't like that. And they weren't really big huggers, but I decided I needed hugs because I was alone. And if I don't get the hugs in this room, I'm the kind of girl who's going to go out and get them in a bar. You know, I'm just going to go get them in the wrong places. And so I started hugging in those meetings. And by the time I left my little Queens, New York meetings, they were huggers. They were all huggers. And so that was really cool. But I also did what you know, tell me to do here. I was of service, and I was struggling at one point, and I had found a sponsor at this time, and I was kind of still struggling with that whole step four thing. It's really hard when you come in with fighting gloves with God because of all the shit that's happened to you. Like, how could there really be a loving God if you could let that stuff happen to me, you know? And I was really struggling with this idea. So I'd heard about a convention at one of my meetings. I didn't know where it was. It was in Sleepy Hollow. How cool is that? The home of the Headless Horseman. Yeah, I'm going to that convention. So I hopped in my little car, and I drove out through some really beautiful countryside in New York, and it was feeling really nice, and I did what you told me to do. I knew that the possibility of finding a banquet ticket was going to be slim to none, and I went up and said, well, if anybody still has a ticket, and just as I did that, somebody came walking up and said, I have a ticket. And I went into the banquet, and I sat at the very end of the table, you know, the very back table with people I didn't know, and I introduced myself, and the speaker came on, and I don't know her name. I call her Mary. In my head, she's Mary. And Mary was telling her horrific story, and she said, as a grown adult woman, double-digit years in program, she was still struggling with her concept of a loving God. And one day, she was in the hospital visiting a very sick person, and she went to the hospital chapel and kneeled down and looked up at God and said, why God, why did you let those people do those things to me? And Mary heard as clearly as you hear me today God's voice, and he called her by name and said, Mary, when those people did those things to you, I asked them to stop. They chose not to. So I gave you the tools you needed to survive. And that was a spiritual awakening for me. You know, I wanted that. I needed that. I don't know if I was supposed to be in New York for any other reason but to hear that at that convention that day. I went back and started working on my fourth step, and I did to my sponsor at the time exactly what other sponsees have done to me. I vomited the worst thing I had ever done in my entire life all over her. And I need you to know this about the sponsor that I chose in New York. She was a saint. When she walked in the room, this is what I saw. Another, just so you know how twisted and perverted my brain is. When she walked into the room, I heard choirs of angels. I heard doves. I saw doves floating through the room. I saw this light around her. She was perfect. Her voice sounded like singing. She was my version of Snow White singing to the deer, you know? And I picked her as my sponsor, and when she traveled a lot, so I had that new, the spiral brown, large, you know, blueprints for progress, and I'm doing the first part. And the first part does not tell you anywhere in the first part to vomit the worst thing about you. But here I am talking to this woman over the phone, and I am vomiting. I'm reading this stuff, and I wrote about the worst thing that would ever happen because I knew what was going to happen. That saintly woman was going to hang up. I knew she was going to tell me to find a new sponsor. I knew she was going to tell me that this program wouldn't work for me. I knew because I had done something that if I had done as an adult, I could have had severe legal consequences for. And you see, I just knew she was going to shame me. When I was silent, she said, I am so sorry. I am so sorry you were so young and you had nowhere to go with all of that, and that you've carried it around all this time. I'm so sorry. See, what I didn't know at the time is that woman was giving me the gift of grace. The gift of grace that only can come from a loving higher power. She was, as Denise calls it, she was my God with skin on that day. You know, she was my God with skin on. And you know, if you have not done your fourth step, please do not rob yourself of the gift of grace. Please do not. I was going along in my program. I ended up back in California, and I was looking for a new sponsor. And I am not. What time am I at? I just kind of want to know. Oh, perfect. I'm in the right spot. Okay. So I came back to California, and I am looking for a new sponsor. Now, I'm still not very mature. I don't get these people who, after 3 years, are like running the convention. I don't get those people. I mean, they've done all their step work and they've done everything. I'm not like that. I am slow. I've got to do this program. I've got a lot of healing and a lot of scars to mend, you know. I can't do it right away. So I'm looking for a new sponsor, and I'm not very sophisticated in my thought yet. And I am hearing people at meetings, and I am discounting them for every word they say. Every word they say. I will find, no matter how, 99% of what they said was fabulous, but they tripped up on that one word. You can't be my sponsor, I'd say. Before I had left for New York, I had attended one meeting at the Alano Club in West Covina, and there was a woman who was leading that meeting, and I only caught about 10 minutes of her pitch. I can't tell you anything that she said other than this. That woman said that she had gone to college for her MRS degree, and I thought that was funny. I thought that was real. I liked that. I also knew that that woman had a very impressive vocabulary, and I really liked that she wore cool bohemian scarves and jewelry. And I went to meetings with that woman. Anybody who knows you can, who knows her and goes to meetings with you, can tell you she talks, and she talks at every single meeting. But when I came back from New York, she did not say a word, meeting after meeting after meeting, and I was waiting for her to talk so I could judge her and discount her too. And finally one day I gave up waiting for her to say something in the meeting, and I walked up to her and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, hold on honey, I'm having a conversation, sit down and wait. Okay. And I sat down. And when she was having her conversation, she sat down and next to me, and she put her hand on my knee, and I have to tell you that every single fiber of my being tensed up in absolute terror and fear, because I had already learned by that point, if you touched me, it meant you were going to hurt me. It meant you wanted something from me. There was no good touch up until that point. She talked to me, and I left that room crying, because I realized that's why I was there. That's why I was there. That's why I needed this woman. It had to be someone I couldn't discount and somebody who touched me. That woman has helped me go through the most horrific thing, parts of my life. We started working on our steps, and I was working on my fourth step with her, and we had to stop because I began to suffer PTSD from the rape that I had. And I want to tell you about how you love me here, and that you've always loved me before I could love myself. She sent me to an early step study. She sent me to a step study meeting, and you know why I kept coming back? Because Carolyn and little Yolanda, I don't know if you're in here, they back there, they remembered my name, and they didn't know me from my mom, and they gave me hugs, and they were always happy to see me after the very first meeting I walked into with them. So I kept going to that little step study, and thank God I did. You know, that's where I found my sponsor. I working on my fourth step, and I have to stop because I'm suffering this PTSD. And I, one day I'm walking into a meeting and I'm just sobbing through the whole meeting. You know, I haven't been near this person. I hadn't been near this person in years, and I'm still like, I'm looking around like the car is going to drive up or something. And I am dying inside. My sponsor couldn't stay late that night. She had to take care of something with her husband, and she turned me over to Emily. And Emily stayed with me in that parking lot for over an hour in the middle of the night. It was a late meeting. It was a late meeting, and it ended late. Emily looked at me, and I've got just tears coming down my face and puffy eyes, and I've got snot dripping down my nose and into my mouth, and I don't care, and I'm just sobbing, and I can barely speak, and I'm telling Emily everything. Emily looks at me, and I will never forget this. Grown woman. She takes her hand and she just wipes it across my nose and face. Who does that? We do. We do. I'll wipe the snot off your face if you need me to. I will. It's been done for me. She lived. She lived. It's okay. And then Emily said something to me that I could not believe, and as a mom today, I still think is amazing. She said to me, "I know this isn't going to mean a whole lot to you right now, but someday, please think about today. Please think about the woman who is going through what you went through, because someday you will get to be there for that other person. That other person could be my own daughter." Maya, she put her own daughter there. God. And she meant it. She meant it, you know? And that's the kind of love that we have here today, you know? That helped me tremendously. I got through the PTSD by the love and faith in these rooms. I did have you to use a little bit of outside help, but she could see. She actually said, "No, I think you're going to be okay. I see that you have a program. I see that you have support." And it also helped that I lived with a therapist at the time. So she said, "You give her my number and you tell her, I think you're going to be okay." And I got through that with this program. I kept going along my merry way through this program, and I found a relationship that I loved, and I found a relationship that I thought was going to be it, and I was doing it in program, and I thought, this is great. That relationship did not work out the way I thought, and I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated, but something happened to me by the time that relationship ended. I was okay. I loved him dearly, but he didn't take away a piece of me. For the first time in my life, somebody didn't take a piece of me when they walked on down the road. And I was surprised by this. I continued working on my steps, and I got through step nine. And step nine is a very big part of my spiritual program today. I was carrying a lot of weight of the world on my shoulders until step nine, and I thought that the first person I was going to make my amends to would be my mother. Of course, she's an Al-Anon, she'll get it, this is going to be a piece of cake. And that is also what my sponsor said. So I sat down to write her a letter, and I couldn't do it, and I couldn't do it, and I couldn't do it. And one day I woke up, and she said, "Well, why don't you start with your dad? He's deceased. Why don't you go do a graveside letter?" I'm like, "I can do that." So I did that. And then shortly after that, I found myself writing an amends letter to the man who raped me. And I called up my sponsor when I was done. I said, "I don't know why I did this, but I wrote this letter." And she said, "Great." And she said, "So now what you're going to do is call him up." And I thought, isn't she supposed to say I make a living amends at this point? So I I did what she said. I called him up, and she gave me instructions. She said, you're going to meet him in a public place in the daylight so that you can feel safe. I already know that you're going to walk in and out of this situation unscathed and that God will be with you. And I did what she said. I met him in a public place, and she said, because this can be so emotional for you, I want you to read the letter and say nothing else. I said, okay. And I did that. And I went to this man who had harmed me for years, and I read my letter. Now, I have to tell you that on the day that I got raped by him, I remember feeling like I was less than human. I remember feeling like I cannot be here, because when you look up and you say no, and they continue on, and you say no, and they continue on, you must not be human. You must be something less than, because how could you do that to another human being? And so I had walked around for years with this shell of a person, just a shell, if that. And I met this man anyway, trusting in my God and trusting that God that you had given me and trusting in my sponsor. And I went and I met this man and I read this letter. And when I was done, he said to me, oh my God. Oh my God. That had to be so hard to look at yourself like that. To see those things about yourself and come here and tell me. Nowhere in that letter did I ever talk about him or what he had done. I only talked about my own part. And you see, the power that it gave me that day, that it was that I knew without a doubt it had nothing to do with him, that it had everything to do with me, and that I was walking away there with that piece of me that I had left behind, with all those pieces of me that I'd left behind. And every single ninth step amends after that was picking up my pieces and plugging it back into the shell and putting this woman that is here before you together. You know, and I'm not going to say together again, because I am different today. I'm not the woman that I was before. You know, and I am so grateful that I got to make that amends. And I have to tell you, I had to make other amends that I really didn't like, that were less dramatic and emotional, and, you know, like financial amends and things like that. And you know, here's the thing about making amends. I don't know about you, but I never encountered anyone on my amends list who said, oh, no, 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 you didn't do all of those things. Oh my God, I'm the one who didn't leave her phone off. Can you do that? Because it's going to go again. So I've made my amends and I'm doing my deal. And I am a firm believer in not, if you can be alone, I think it's really cool to be alone. People like me need to be alone when they're doing their step work, especially up until step 9, because I had a lot of baggage to unload before I could really truly be in the right relationship. I just was not in the right space or time. Thank you. And I finally had made the majority of my amends, and I am so grateful. Even to that guy that I thought I loved and wanted to be with forever, this is the funny thing. I have now come to understand that even when I didn't know that they might just have a drinking or drugging problem, I was dating them. I was clueless, even in program. That man that I had fallen deeply in love with, I now realize most people don't supply their friends with drugs at parties. Normal people don't say to you one week, you know, I don't like how drinking's making me feel. I think I'm going to stop it for a while. Do you have tea instead? And then, that's on a Thursday night. And then on Saturday night, hey, did you open up the bottle of wine yet? Like, making those promises that they're going to stop. I had no clue I was dating someone whose drinking might just bother me later on, you know? And of course I did. But I really think that when we make our amends, we really unload a lot of our baggage of our past. I know that that happened for me, and I'm grateful because I finally became ready. My life was going really, really well. And I'm starting to pay down this huge, enormous debt that I had been left with as a result of my marriage. And I am working, and I'm not threatening my bosses anymore. And I'm doing really well. And my last boss, he called me classy. And, you know, that was all you. And on the days I didn't want to show up at work, my sponsor would say, you get to. And I would say, okay. And I would do it anyway. And today I have a very, a really good reputation in my career of choice. And I have been very successful at it. And I'm in this little apartment, and I'm paying my bills, and I'm doing my deal, and I'm living, and I'm living the program that you have given me, and I am working it and believing it, and I'm service, and I'm sponsoring, and I'm reading, and I'm meditating. And one day, I'm walking out of my little apartment, and I'm a little bit dramatic from time to time, and I'm about to leave to go to work, and I drop my bags for work, my bag for work, drop it on the floor, and I say, damn it, and I slam the wall right next to the door, and the picture starts shaking, and I think it's going to fall on me, and it's really heavy. And I look up at the ceiling, and I said, that's it, God. Bring it on. I'm ready. And I'm yelling. I'm sure my neighbors upstairs could hear me. I am yelling at the top of my lungs, bring it on. I am ready. Whatever you have in store for me, I don't care. I am not picking another man. It's going to be your man, the way you want it, the way you decide. I'm not doing this. Bring it on. And he did. That was a Thursday. Saturday morning, I'm babysitting my little niece, and she was hanging out with me for the day, and we're swimming in our pool, and I said to her, you know, I'm going to this big party. It was my 20th high school reunion. I said, I'm going to this big party tonight. And she said, oh, good. What are you wearing? We were talking about it, and she said, you know what, Dee Dee? I think you should try eHarmony. I had been single for a few years by this point, by choice and sponsored direction. And I think that my family was starting to worry that I might be gay. And so I had been... So my little niece is saying, I think you should try eHarmony. I said, oh, really? Why try eHarmony? Well, she had a plan. She said, I think you should try eHarmony because I want you to find a boyfriend, and then you'll find a boyfriend, you'll get married, and you'll have kids, and I will have a little niece. And I said, oh, well, this party I'm going to tonight, maybe I'll meet somebody. No, Titi, you're not going to meet somebody there. I said, you're probably right. It's a good thing. I'm going because I really want a change of jobs, and maybe I'll meet my next job. I did. I didn't know what kind of job. I walked into that room, and I did what you sometimes tell me to do. I sandwiched it. I called somebody before I'm going to go walk into my reunion, and I called somebody after. I sandwiched. And it keeps me grounded. It'd also keep me out of trouble, because if I know I have to report after I get out of the place I'm going into... I better be on best behavior. My sponsor says, you carry this program in all of your affairs, everywhere you go, and whatever you do, because you don't know who's watching you from across a crowded room, even in the grocery store. And so I try to do that. I walked into this little room, and it's dark, and I thought, I must be in the wrong room because there's a lot of gray hair in here. I literally walked out, checked the name on the door, and walked back in. Oh, great. This is how old I am. And I'm sitting and I'm talking to people. And from across the room, just like my sponsor says it happens, somebody was standing. And he saw me walk in. And he looked across the room and he thought to himself, I have no idea who she is. I don't know if I went to school with her. I don't know if she's sitting here bringing or coming here with somebody else, but I need to find out. And he walked across the room, and that man has not left me alone since. So when I say I found a new job, I really did. We were living together 3 months after that date. You know, it was for the first time something I knew without a doubt was where I was supposed to be in a relationship. I never had to go polling, asking my friends, you know, getting permission, getting approval, not even from my parents. This is a funny story. If you would have given me the crystal ball a million years ago, I would have said, oh, no, thank you. He's not my guy. See, my guys always had blue hair and fingernails that were black and tattoos and earrings and ripped up pants. And they didn't look like him. He was normal. He is normal. My sponsor still says, we have no idea what kind of cloth he's cut from, but thank God he saw your potential. I remember when I was first dating him, we were in Hermosa Beach, and my youngest sister lives there, and we went up. I had to use the restroom, and for the first time ever, I actually was unafraid to take somebody up and meet a family member. So I said, you know what, let's not go to the restaurant right there for the restroom. We can just go around the corner. My sister lives right here. And we went upstairs and we met him. And what I didn't know at the time was that after we left the house and they met my sister, my youngest sister met him, she called up my mom and my sister and said these words, he's normal. That was cool. I was older, and we were trying for a baby, and I didn't know that, you know, I knew it was going to be difficult, and it was, and we had gotten to the point of complete and utter exhaustion at trying, at least I had, and they referred us to fertility doctors, and I researched it, because that's what I do, I'm, you know, an Al-Anon, I figure it all out, right, and I interviewed several women, and I knew exactly what I was going to be facing, and I realized it was not, it didn't fit for me. It was not what I needed to be doing. And so I gave up and I decided to go back to school and get a master's degree. And my husband, I said, our plan, we're going to buy fancy cars and travel around the world for all the money that we would have spent on a kid anyway. And he said, that's great, honey. That's great. And lo and behold, 1 month into my classes, I'm pregnant. I'm pregnant. And that little girl is the love of my life. You see, before I got here, and on that very first date that my husband took me on, he asked me three questions that I swore no one asks these questions on a first date. What do you think about God? What do you think about marriage? What do you think about kids? Are you kidding me? And I had answers that didn't agree with his ideas. You know, I never really wanted to get married again. I never really wanted to have children. I was just so afraid. I was so afraid of the shit I'd pass on. Just the shit I'd pass on. I just didn't trust myself. I didn't know that I could be a mom. And through this program, I gave that idea up, and I desperately wanted a child, and we went through that together, and we had this amazing little girl. And then, you know, life is not perfect. Life is good. Life is good. It is not perfect. And a couple of years ago, I desperately wanted a second child, and I got pregnant, and I was on cloud nine, and I thought I was going to have my perfect, happy little family, and I miscarried that child on the day before Christmas Eve. And I was so angry at God, and I am so grateful that I have a God that you told me I could be angry at. I didn't tell anybody, and I stuffed it down, and I cut back on my meetings. I cut back on my service. I still kept going. I knew I needed to be here. I didn't read every day, but I kept coming, and I was angry, and I didn't talk about that baby that I lost, but it meant everything to me that day. And, you know, thank God my husband one day said to me after about a year and a half, said to me, "Don't you have that convention thing you go to every September?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." And God damn it, when I showed up at that convention, guess who said to me, "Do you have a commitment at this convention?" "Dell." I said, "No, I don't." She said, "Go sit down at the literature table." And I said, "Okay." And I was back in the fold. I was back in the fold. You know, and I went back to my three meetings a week, and I was calling my sponsor, and I'm doing my deal. And thank God I did that, because I got the relief I needed here. You know, I talked to somebody in the rooms who had been through a loss like mine, and she gave me some homework. Karen, I don't know if you're here, you gave me homework that night, and you told me to go do something, and I went and I did it. And it was the biggest release that I have ever had. And it made me have complete faith and trust in a loving higher power to know that my life is exactly where it's supposed to be today. And I am so grateful. You know, if you were to put that same canvas I asked you to imagine with all the people, places, and things in front of you in your lives today, if you were to ask me to picture that in front of my life, even with the ugliest parts of my life, the ugliest things I have done, the ugliest things that have been done to me, and you were to hand me that eraser today, I would not erase a thing. I have gone, I don't believe we have to have a blank slate here. I believe we can learn to do what this convention theme is all about, accept. I can accept every single part of my past. I can believe that it is not just something that I have need to tolerate, not just something that I need to learn to live with. It is something that I can look at and receive as a precious gift from a loving God. And if you don't believe that's true for you, just believe that it's true for me, because that is enough. Thank you for letting me be here, and thank you for letting me share.
This recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.